Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Saracini.
I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And the two of us are flying solo today.
Flying duet.
I guess that would be right, yeah. Not flying solo. Flying duet. Because Tosin is at PAX, I believe, in Boston. The Penny Arcade Game Expo.
That's right. Oh, I mean, the fact that content can have its own expo is just fantastic.
I'm a little jealous. I've never been to PAX. I've always wanted to go, but it's usually outside of my if it's outside of my sort of driving range, it's a hard sell to go to it.
Yeah.
Anyway, this week the heart of internet security is bleeding. Stock traders game the system. A Twitter to destabilize Cuba. Game of Thrones pushes piracy to a new high. And are we at 3D printing's tipping point? All this and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. And if you subscribe to us on iTunes, please leave us a review. Tell us how we're doing. Facebook.com and Twitter.com at The Drill Down. And you can always write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I had planned last week to talk about Goat Simulator, but I didn't actually get a chance to really dive into it much, so I'm tabling that for next week's episode. But there's a couple things that I did play with this week, and I'd like to talk about that. One is a new iPad app from a development team called Us2 out of the UK, and the game is called Monument Valley. And Monument Valley is one of those games that argues the point that video games can be considered art. And Monument Valley, the best way that I can describe Monument Valley is it has the design aesthetic of Fez, the gameplay mechanics of Echo Chrome, if you remember Echo Chrome from the PS3 and from the the mini PS. And it also has a touch of Journey's mystique. So essentially, you play a character named Princess Ida, and you guide your character through these M.C. Escher-like paths, and you can manipulate the path to help Ida reach her goal. And it's just a beautiful-looking game, has some beautiful music to it, and along the way, there's this sort of story about a lost civilization that you're traveling through the ruins of, that gives it sort of that Journey mystique to it. It's a great little game. It's a short game. There's only like 10, maybe 10 or 11 levels in the whole game. So you'll get through it. You can get through the whole game in a couple of hours. You have to answer the question for yourself, is it worth the $3.99 at the iTunes App Store? But I think it's such a beautiful game that it's totally worth the blind buy.
Did you cry?
No. Not in the same way that I did at the end of Journey, which I admit, yeah, I did cry at the end of Journey, man. That was a moving moment. I replayed Journey recently, too.
Okay. I mean, also, like, the other one, what's it called? Bioshock Infinite.
Bioshock Infinite is another one that I admit that I got a little weepy at the end of.
Yeah.
But yeah, Monument Valley, it's cute. It's charming little game. It's beautiful looking. It's great music, and it's it borders on the cusp of art. The other thing I wanted
to... games have to become art. I mean, that's just like how we have art house film.
Yeah.
I think you're recognizing a new genre that is art house game. And I think one of the places where that can exist pretty freely because the interfaces aren't as robust is mobile devices like iPads and iPhones and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. This it reminds me a little bit like another game that falls in line with that sort of bordering on art is Device 6, which I had talked about in a previous episode of The Drill Down. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the new comedy from Mike Judge, the animator and screenwriter behind Beavis and Butthead and Office Space. It's called Silicon Valley, and it premiered this weekend on HBO.
I saw that.
Yeah. It's well the sort of the nut graph synopsis is it's partially inspired by Mike Judge's own experiences as a Silicon Valley engineer in the late 80s. It follows an introverted programmer named Richard and focuses on his compression algorithm hidden within his new music site when his Google-like employer Hooli and a venture capitalist discover the algorithm, a bidding war emerges.
It's kind of like all about the Easter egg inside the thing that he wants to do.
Yeah.
But the problem for me is that this is Mike Judge guy. He was a developer in the 80s in Silicon Valley, and that was the 80s, mm-hmm. and we're 30 years out, and shit had changed. Shit just changed a lot. And while he does capture some of this whole VC situation...
Yeah.
It's... To me, it wasn't exciting because it was just typical, like prototypical, I'm a geek who doesn't get people or girls or whatever. And I feel like that's been explored a lot. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping for more. I was hoping for something that was on the level of the Newsroom, Game of Thrones, something that represented HBO. You know, they can take the buddy cop and make a True Detective. They can take the fantasy situation to make Game of Thrones. They can make, you know, they can take the political drama and create a great comedy like Veep or they can take the new show and make The Newsroom. And these are things that like are, you know, intellectually curious, blow your mind, whatever. This to me is, I don't know, I saw an episode of Entourage. I was a little bit reminded of that when I watched this.
There's a lot of people comparing it to Entourage.
Entourage sucked the dick of death from my perspective. So for me, I look at the show and I just feel like it was a waste of half hour of my life. But I did respect that the coveted piece of technology was one that would be coveted in our world right now. That was like the one saving grace for me of viewing the show.
Yeah, there was a little bit of verisimilitude to that.
Right. It wasn't like when you watch any kind of hacking show, like I got it through this like tunnel. It wasn't a lot.
And they
bullshit.
Make up some like, sort of arcane,
some sort of stupid nonsense BS stuff. So
right.
it was really clever how this guy's interested in the goofy music, whatever. But in fact, it's technology that he doesn't randomly understand. That's kind of what annoys me too. That he doesn't understand where the gold mine is, and that's in his ability to search compressed documents. So there's something there, but whatever.
I appreciate the fact that the whole Silicon Valley, the whole Silicon Valley setting and the world of Silicon Valley is getting starting to become reflected in popular media.
Well, it started with the Facebook movie, The Social Network, which is the level that I expected HBO to hang out at. Aaron Sorkin super level, but this is kind of like a piece of junk.
Well, this is Mike. So, this is first of all, I mean, this is Mike Judge. So, you know,
what did you say he was responsible for again?
Beavis and Butthead and Office Space. So you have to know
Office Space was pretty good, but this is not as good as Office Space. I think the whole Workaholics place is actually kind of filling out that Office Space space. What's really interesting about Office Space is that
if you guys remember Office Space, they have this thing called a TPS report.
Right.
In Office Space.
Right.
I was I moved into a new place. I had to get some furniture, and I went to CB2, which is Crate and Barrel's kind of like youthful modern space. And they have a cabinet that I bought. It's a thing for like your files. It's called the TPS cabinet. And it's clearly a knockoff of Office Space. Homage to Office Space. Like, you know, you can put your reports in there because it's all just like a hanging folder, kind of like keep your files here in your house kind of thing. And it's a beautiful little thing. It's got wheels. You can lock them, all that stuff. So we got three of those puppies under the little table like they kind of suggest you do. And it's been great. But for Office Space's legacy, it's great to see that, you know, almost a decade after, there's this, you know, really trendy company that's making a TPS cabinet that is where it works. So,
yeah.
But this whole Silicon Valley. First of all, the name Silicon Valley, eh. You know what would be exciting for me? There's a incubator called TechStars.
Yeah.
Having a show about what it's like to be in an incubator, the competition, the other people around, the ideas, all that. That could be exciting.
I thought that there was a show either in development or already airing a reality-based show where they basically was about incubators. And it was either on A&E or it's still in development and hasn't been released yet.
Yeah, I mean, the incubator is really where a lot of this technology is exciting.
And that's the setting for this show also, Silicon Valley.
There's not the setting. It's part of this. He's in an incubator from a guy who's kind of a jerk. Whereas if you look at like a true incubator, like this TechStars thing, which is like based in Boulder, but like really big in New York, really big in Silicon Valley, got the Foundry Group behind it, like a really large and robust organization. It's kind of like this is where the elite go once they get accepted to make things happen, to move our lives forward, to have real impact. And just like the newsroom or so many others kind of take us and say, hey, look, this is how the story could have played out if we saw it when it like happened, when it broke on the news. That would be exciting to see, you know, how possible fake companies or even real companies actually like did it. I don't know. I'm going in hindsight 2020 after having seen Silicon Valley, but I just feel like I love tech too much to let this represent tech.
What's interesting about this is the, you know, now that Silicon Valley is kind of in the zeitgeist of popular media, a year or so ago there was a Amazon Prime series that premiered called Alphas that is basically about the same, covers the same space.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that HBO saw this, just like how Apple saw the Nexus 7 and said, we need one. So Apple made the iPad mini, and HBO is chasing down Alphas.
I think in comparison, Silicon Valley is better than Alphas, but I think it's not as good as it could be. However, I will cut Mike Judge a little slack based on his track record. I'm going to say that this show could get a lot better.
Yeah, I'll give you that, because for me, you need at least 5 or 6 episodes before you really can tell how a show is going to like turn out.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need a whole season, like with Continuum. You need like a whole season to figure out how it's going to like actually be worth it or not worth it. So there's that. I'll give you that. But yeah, so I say that there's still a chance to get this right.
Yeah.
But from what I've seen, I never want to see it again.
Well, there you go.
I just think the main actor doesn't do it for me.
Yeah.
The Indian guy, the one piece of diversity in the show, is completely stereotypical. It's Silicon Valley, but there are no people of Asian descent. Like what the hell is this? You know? Like it's just some like, I don't know, it's just some sort of weird, I mean, you can't go to Northern California and see Asian people everywhere. And I'm looking at the show and I'm like, wait, what's missing, right? Yeah, I don't know. I don't. And it's kind of like there's room, especially in today's reality of Silicon Valley, to show the female developers.
Sure.
To show there's just a lot
I'm
to be
sure
seen
it's
there.
Coming.
And it's, you can say it's coming, but it's just kind of this like weird unilateral you know, for lack of a better term, super white Anglo-Saxon Protestant look at what maybe Silicon Valley is to someone who hasn't been in Silicon Valley since the 80s. That's what I see. And for me, I have to walk away from that. All right. I need something better. I have higher standards.
Well, it's worth giving a shot. In fact, HBO has released the pilot on YouTube for free.
I think it's also on iTunes for free.
Yeah, so we're going to make that our drill down video of the week, and we'll probably mention it again at the end of the show. But we'll have.
And kudos to HBO for making, you know, taking a piece of subject matter that is obviously tech friendly and putting it out there on the channels to go. Because as we'll talk about later with Game of Thrones, you know, like, geek is chic right now. Mm-hmm, and if you've got anything that's sci-fi, fantasy, tech, the geeks of the world are going to want to see it. So opening them up to it and then, like, doing cool shit like saying, hey, share your HBO Go passwords, that's going to be good. And that'll help kill the scourge that you guys believe is piracy. So there's that. So I think it's very clever for them to put it on YouTube. It's going to save them a lot of hassle. They're kind of like, let me just throw Google all the bandwidth that's necessary to download this puppy.
Yeah. Good for them. So you have your own opportunity to check out the pilot of Silicon Valley and make up your own mind about it. All right, let's get into some of these headlines here. Last week we talked about Brendan Eich, who is the new CEO for Mozilla. That
and how OkCupid wanted to call him out for supporting Proposition 8, which is a California law against gay marriage. That's what we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, we'd wondered, well, what's going to be the upshot of all of this? Will he be asked to resign? Well, this week, Brendan Eich did resign as CEO of Mozilla. In an interview with Mozilla's executive chairwoman, Mitchell Baker, she said that Eich's ability to lead the company that makes the Firefox web browser has been badly damaged by the continued scrutiny over this hot button issue. He's out. But you know, there's an interesting side of this that I think also needs to be explored. Scripting News's Dave Weiner says that he says, I quote, I think we just crossed a line that we should have avoided. There was no need to force out Eich. Prop 8 was overturned. Same-sex marriage is legal in a lot of states, and it's on its way to being legal everywhere. People may have forgotten how quickly this change happened. In 2008, when Eich made the contribution, the proposition passed in California. It wasn't a minority opinion. So if change happens again, and maybe it's not the kind of change that you like, anyone who gave to any political cause is in danger. Dave Weiner posits the question, where do you draw the line? How much politics does there have to be in what you do for it to be wrong to have positions that are unpopular to enough people to make your employment a problem? Will you have to know the politics of every person you do business with in the future? What if you're...
I mean, business is about... I mean, I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah. No.
I see his point, but business is about relationships. And relationships are traditionally beyond people you trust. You talk about the old boy network. Remember that? A big piece of that was the fact that a whole bunch of guys who could sit around talking about a whole bunch of girls and have a drink of whiskey, they trusted one another.
Yeah.
They liked one another. They got along with one another. And that level of trust allowed them to do business together. Three men in a room choosing a president. All that stuff was based on the idea that, like, they shared a similar culture. The culture of Silicon Valley currently is about science, is about freedom, and is about progress. And we talk about, like, the political term progressive. It stems from the fact that people there, people who choose to live there, people who want to live there, are people who are like, I want to move whatever exists forward. I don't want the trappings of the old, right? Like, I want to create a new way of knowing. I want to create a system that allows people to crowdsource traffic data so I can get where I need to go faster. I want to create – that's Waze, right? I want to create a bit of technology that sits in my pocket that allows me to understand how active I've been all day long. That's Fitbit or Jawbone or whatever. These people are looking at new ways of being – And the idea that someone could come up and take the biggest symbols of openness and freedom and all that stuff, Mozilla, and be the leader of it was anathema to them, regardless of what I think. It was clearly anathema to the individuals around that. Now, when you look at OkCupid, which we talked about, OkCupid is obviously it's in Silicon Valley. It's very, very focused on making love connections. So you take this idea of openness and progressive and all that stuff, and you look at OkCupid, and like on top of all that, their job is to make love connections. And anyone who stands in technology's way to make love connections, aka or more love connections, like if they have to go with just a heterosexual base, it's less people than they can do if they can go with the homosexual base. So the idea that they can't, you know, there's someone standing in the way in tech, in a browser, which is a conduit to their service, that is in the way of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered love connections, gets in the way of their ability to make money. And that's one of the big pieces of this. OkCupid got involved because they were like, this is getting in the way of my ability to make dollars. You and what you stand for, what you openly stood for. And I think that's one of the issues you have to think about. In Silicon Valley, if you want to work in technology, you need to either open up a fucking shell company and put your money in that, or you need to, you know, just abstain from the political stuff. Mm-hmm. Because people are focused on this idea of moving forward with no restrictions and no ties to the old ways of being, the traditional ways of being. That's, you just can't do that if you want to move forward in Silicon Valley, if you want to move forward in technology. Technology is about getting away from all that stuff. So if you stand in anybody's way, they're going to go after you. And it's an incredibly, you know, open-minded and open-focused place. So it's going to be easy to paint you as a negative. And so I think his mistake was that once you become a public figure, if you're going to take a CEO position, if you're going to take a C-level position at a high-end firm, if you're going to become president, if you're going to become any of these, we saw this with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. If you're going to become any of these things,
you're open to deep scrutiny.
Yeah, you're open to crazy scrutiny. And the minute you do anything revolve around sex, whether it's hooking up with an intern like Slick Willie, or going into, you know, making a donation about who can have sex with whom and get married about it or whatever, you're opening yourself up for that kind of scrutiny. And OkCupid got a crazy amount of press, and there are people in the technorati who said this is like a terrible thing. And other people in technorati said, who cares? Just like when Bill Clinton was with Monica Lewinsky, people said, who cares? But the fact is, this is something you need to avoid. You need to not be part of that conversation. You need to focus on your technology and making it accessible to as many people as possible, to get as many users as possible, to get the best evaluation as possible. Because in the end, these guys want their money, and these guys want to change the world. And they can't do that if you're trying to keep the world the same, which is what Brendan Eich was trying to do with his donation to Prop 8. Now, was it popular in California? Yes. It's true. It's absolutely true. But, I mean, there's plenty of times when shit's been popular, but it hasn't been tied to people's rights. Like, the Civil Rights Act was not popular across this entire country, but Lyndon Johnson pushed it through anyway. He had to use the death of a president to do it. It was pretty much ridiculous how he said, basically, you know, John Kennedy's dead 5 days after the guy died. He goes, in order to do his legacy, we have to do the civil rights thing, even though nobody wanted to do it in Congress, and most of the people in the country didn't want to do it. But he saw it as rights, and rights have to be pushed forward, regardless of what the population thinks, because that's why we have a representative democracy, because the representatives are supposed to be able to speak for us. Now, do they fuck up? Obviously, they fuck up. They fuck up all the time. Look at Congress today. Yep. But the bottom line is, you know, a majority in a country that's supposed to protect the rights of the minority, which is how this country is designed, which is why we have a Senate, doesn't mean anything. So I think this guy's writing is it's too apologetic for nonsense. Like, you can't say, well, a majority of people liked it back then. That's not how it works. That's not how rights work. It's never been how rights work. Not in this country. You should read a book. And it's kind of harsh to say that, and he probably is not going to like me for it, but that's just kind of how it is. Like, if you look at people's rights, it's not about the majority, because there's no majority in the world that looks at a minority and says, let's give them the same rights that we have. That's just, everyone's afraid of losing jobs. Everyone's afraid of doing whatever. It takes representative democracy and a good judiciary to become the best self of the entire country and push that forward. And I think Silicon Valley in many ways is trying to make itself the best self of the entire country put forward. I mean, you could people like visionaries like Mark Zuckerberg, and there's a Republican lean there. Mm-hmm. You know, he's supporting Chris Christie. He's doing some other things. Even Bill Gates has a Republican lean. But these are usually in the space of business and not this whole culture war nonsense, which is nonsense. We shouldn't be fighting about culture in a country that's not supposed to have rules about culture. So, you know, there's ways to be a Republican. And like Lord knows on this show, I am the conservative. But it's just one of those things where I look at this Robert Icke guy and I think he basically made a big mistake that cut down the credibility of Mozilla, which needs credibility in a world of Chrome and a new IE that's actually reasonable. And that's a problem. He should have thought about that before he did it. Like if he, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if I'm in a car, I'm driving my car and a cop stops me for no good reason. I'm not going to mouth off to the cop because it's my right, because I know my position in the real world. Just like how, yeah, it's his right to like give money to whomever he wants, but he has to understand his position in the real world. And as a tech leader, he's going to be ostracized.
Who knew when he was contributing his $1,000 back in, you know, back in 2008,
yeah, or whatever.
That it would come back and bite him on the butt as he was CEO of Microsoft in 2013.
Of Mozilla, yeah.
Mozilla. I mean, of Mozilla, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. You really have to think about that if you have the kind of ambition that a guy like, I mean, he's a smart guy. You don't become CEO of Mozilla for any reason, but for no reason. But, you know, it's one of those things where you have to really think about what it is you represent publicly to people. Like, if you're like Barack Obama himself, when he was running in 2008, said, I'm against gay marriage. I like civil unions. But he only said that because he wanted to get elected. He clearly wanted gay marriage. He was clearly okay with gay marriage. He's behind it now. There's a politics to what people do.
Yeah.
Like politics is like, you know, it's PR and you can't, you know, you have to know your audience. And in Silicon Valley, that's your audience. So he I think he just played the politics wrong. Lord knows I've done it in my own jobs.
Okay, moving on here. Big news. Probably the biggest story of the week. Researchers announced a massive vulnerability in the popular web encryption software called OpenSSL. SSL allows web users to protect the privacy of information they transmit over the internet. When you visit a secure website such as gmail.com, you'll see a little lock next to the URL. Indicating that your communications with the site are encrypted. That lock is supposed to signal that third parties won't be able to read any information you send or receive. On Monday, researchers announced a serious bug in the software that exposes users' communications to eavesdropping. And apparently, OpenSSL has had this flaw for about 2 years. And the way it works is that the SSL standard includes a heartbeat option, which allows a computer at one end of the SSL connection to send a short message to verify that the other computer is still online and get a response back. Researchers found that it's possible to send a cleverly formed malicious heartbeat message that tricks the computer on the other end into divulging secret information. Specifically, a vulnerable computer can be tricked into transmitting the contents of the server's memory. Unfortunately, there's nothing users can do to protect themselves if they visit a vulnerable website. The administrators of vulnerable websites need to upgrade their software before users can be protected. And once an affected website has fixed the problem on their end, users can protect themselves by changing their passwords.
And that's the biggest thing here. Keeping track of whether the websites you use the most, Google, Yahoo, your bank, your credit cards, Amazon, whatever you're using to buy stuff with, whatever you're using to use to facilitate transactions or communicate effectively with other people, once those people have announced that they fixed it, it's going to suck. Some of you have had passwords for like the last 10 years that you just love.
Yes.
But going in and flipping that password to something new because you don't know if it's been taken.
Right.
Just like how all those credit cards companies, the credit card companies, they sent new cards with new numbers to people after the whole Target breach. It's just a big piece of it. So it's all about waiting. It's all about waiting right now. And I got to say, you know, tax time is coming up. It's the 9th as we record this. Mm-hmm. It'll be the 11th as it gets released. And all that means is that you've got 4 days to do your taxes over TurboTax for most of you, which is an SSL encrypted website, which is clearly going to be under the scrutiny of the hackers. The big thing that happened to this week with this bug is that, you know, hackers who were in the know about the Heartbleed, they didn't call it Heartbleed, but the Heartbleed problem, they were saving it. They were saving it for the most lucrative times to use it. Obviously, you don't want to exploit such a wonderful way to gain access to people's information. But once bloggers started talking about this, the incidences of exploits assuredly skyrocketed as hackers knew that this was going to get fixed soon, so they take advantage of it today, now. So it's kind of weird to think that in the next couple days you're going to be doing your taxes on the internet, and there's a higher chance that companies like TurboTax or whatever are going to be hit hard by the kinds of attacks that allow people to claim this information. Just keep that in mind. And that's kind of all there is to say about it. I mean, it's a shame. I actually wonder here, Andy, you know, Apple 2 weeks ago released iOS 6.16 for 3GS and older phones and 7.1 for iPhone 4 and future phones in order to fix an SSL bug that allowed people to see your encryption. Now, Apple wasn't using OpenSSL, which is the subject of the Heartbleed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or Apple may have been using OpenSSL, which is the subject of the Heartbleed attack. But could it be that Apple determined this same problem 2 weeks ago
independently,
or several weeks ago independently, and put out their fix 2 weeks ago with iOS 6.16 and iOS 7.1? I don't know. I've been looking for the data to support that. I don't know. But the fact is, SSL has been questioned twice in the last month between Apple and between this open SSL issue. So who knows? There's also some speculation out there that SSL was corrupted.
Yeah.
Meaning that OpenSSL, the people who initially put it together or whatever, were corrupted by the NSA in order to let the NSA make use of this tactic in order to grab data.
Yeah.
I don't know how true that is. Very much a blend over supposition.
It's an interesting thing to consider. Bruce Schneier, you know who Bruce Schneier is, a security specialist. He like underscores the severity of this. He says basically on a scale of 1 to 10, this is an 11 of security issues.
It's almost like you're driving over a bridge and whoops, we didn't realize the bridge had a big gap in it every 6 feet.
Right.
You know, that's kind of what's going on here.
You had a password
to get into that club, and everybody knows that password.
Right. It's more like, you know, you have a safe, and only you know the combination to that safe. Yet, in the back of the safe, there's a door without any sort of lock on it that anyone could open it up and take anything they want from your safe. And several times they can do it multiple times.
And it's really weird. I guess the other day I got an email from Netflix saying, "Hey, you've requested to have your password changed."
Yeah.
And I remember asking my girlfriend, I was like, "Hey, did you try to get the password like reset?" She goes, "No." And to me, that's a symbol of hacking, right? Like it's just a It's like suddenly, you know, if it were Facebook, then like all my friends would get some random Facebook message. If it were Twitter, then they'd all get a DM, whatever. So I had to go and change my password. This is what's going on with these services today. So just keep that in mind, listeners, and listen out for when you're – there's some sites that are, you know, Google like Heartbleed, is my site affected kind of thing.
Yeah.
Plenty of sites are out there saying, yes, we were affected. And plenty of sites should be fixing it. We should put a link up to that.
We're going to put a link in the show notes of the Alexa top 10,000 sites that are vulnerable. So you can check to see if one of the sites that you visit is amongst those sites.
It's a hot mess. Think about the amount of information garnered by hackers during the whole
early institution of the Affordable Care Act, or on March 31st.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. Like this is not a good thing. But so, it also the question shows up. Open SSL was the vulnerability here. It's an open source SSL protocol. Yeah. Is open source not the way to go? A lot of people are like, well, why use open source? Because anybody should be able to find the problems and let us all know about it.
Yeah, and why? That's a very good question. Why wasn't this vulnerability spotted by many of the people that had their hands in the making of this protocol?
Well, one of the big things is, like, is there a diffusion of responsibility? And by that I mean diffusion of responsibility. Have you ever sent an email to like 6 or 7 people at work, and then everyone's like, and then like you hear nothing back, because everyone who receives the email says, oh, someone else will respond. Mm-hmm. That's a problem that may exist with this sort of open architecture. We just don't know. You have open architecture like Android, where Google's in charge of it, and Google's going to pass it out, but Google has a lot of people working on it. Or like straight up Linux, where you have companies like Red Hat constantly probing and trying to like make it better, see it's secure or whatever. And if they find a vulnerability, they'll share it. Who watches the watchers for OpenSSL? Who's sitting there focusing their time on it? It's unclear. So now, whenever any kind of journalist, reporter, pundit says, does this mean that this protocol isn't good, or does this mean that, you know, ask some really wide question that could be answered yes or no, the answer is always no. So I don't think open source is at risk for screwing anybody in the future. I just think this is one of those things that the system didn't catch.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder what else is out there that the system hasn't caught yet.
Yeah,
too.
No, it's true.
All right, let's move on. Now, this is something that you brought to my attention, Dwayne. I thought it was fascinating. Attorney General Eric H. Holder Jr. announced last Friday that the Justice Department is investigating the practice of high-speed trading on the stock exchanges. He said that they're investigating the use of computer algorithms and ultra-high-speed data networks to execute trades as a possible violation of antitrust laws. The firms that use such tactics, employing physicists and other scientists to predict changes in the markets, sometimes only seconds in advance, have been around for more than 3 decades. But a new book by Michael Lewis, the guy who wrote Moneyball, amongst others, has shed new light on this practice. And you brought this to my attention via an NPR article that you had read.
Yeah, so I follow the stock market pretty closely. I think, especially when it comes to tech stocks. I also follow like high frequency trading very closely. I have a really good friend who actually built a high trading platform back in like 2008 or 2009. One of the big things here is that for a very, very, very long time, traders have been using computers to make trades for them. What does that mean? It used to be that if you watch an old movie like Trading Places or whatever,
yeah,
Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, commodities were trading on the floor where people would make bets. I want to buy corn at this price because I know something from my research that says I can sell it at another price. It's higher. Everyone can make money. One of the big things about that is that when you have a computer making those kinds of choices, you're going to say, hey, look, I'm looking at you over there requested a trade, but I'm going to notice that you requested that trade for 75 cents on the dollar. I'm actually going to buy it at 75 cents on the dollar, realizing that everybody, you and a couple people have asked for it. I'm going to buy it before you can actually buy it, and I'm going to then sell it back to you at 76 cents, so I'm going to make another cent.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on here. People are able to make trades more quickly than the average consumer, or than the average consumer's facilities, than the average mutual fund, than even some hedge funds, by taking their servers and, you know, getting faster processors, getting better algorithms, connecting, you know, getting better fiber optics, fiber networks to the trading hub, building, you know, the nanoseconds that it takes ping napping.
Yeah.
is affected, whether that exchange is in New York, trades you spend, or in New Jersey, where some of the major computer exchanges are. So they actually buy for real estate that's closer to the exchanges so that they can hit the exchange more quickly, figure out what people are asking, and then make a trade based on that. And that's what we're seeing here. Michael Lewis is basically riding the tide of this data and saying, this means that Wall Street is rigged. This means that your mutual fund is getting screwed.
Yeah.
Because whenever your mutual fund that isn't invested in these technologies or can't afford to invest in these technologies is trying to buy stock on your behalf, they're being beat to the punch and they're being sold the stock at a cent more or however much more, and you're losing money. You know? Yeah. It's kind of like that idea, like, what if I could steal the shavings of pennies off of every transaction that
shaving
happens?
Shaving salami. We talked about that in a previous episode.
Right. So that's what's really happening here. And that's what the investigation shows up. Now, is it fair? I don't think anybody knows if it's fair because nobody really knows how it works. So what happened with the financial crash of 2008? No one really knew what was going on. Obfuscation is a big part of finance. If you can make everything really complicated, then regulators don't understand and you can kind of take advantage of the space.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you can figure out new ways to take advantage of the space more quickly than others and not explain how you do it, competitive advantage. So it's not even necessarily malicious that the stuff is complicated. Stuff is complicated because people are always trying to find new ways to the system. And that's really what's going on here. So it's definitely one to watch. The Michael Lewis book is one that we'll talk about a little later, but it's worth reading because it does, as always, it does break down kind of how this is happening, why it's happening, and whether or not it's something you should be concerned about. If you've got a mutual fund, you should be concerned. If you've got a hedge fund because you're rich, you should be really concerned. It's cutting away from a lot of money that's existing in the system. You know, everyone who's ever been able to sort of put together a computer knows all about the idea of, like, I want the best video card, RAM, processor, whatever. The technology that's talked about in here would kick Crysis's ass. It's astounding what can be pulled off if you're sparing no expense for calculation, which is essentially what these computers are doing. Custom operating systems, custom algorithms. When I say custom operating systems, usually versions of Linux. But the idea that they have no threshold on how much money they want to spend on the data connection, the processors, custom-built servers that are really just like moving forward with someone focusing on the hardware, someone focusing on the software, someone focusing – when I say someone, I mean whole teams focusing on the data connections. It's really something. And there's people just focusing on the real estate in order to get these devices as close as possible physically to the servers making these trades. It's really something. It's really something. The tech is astounding.
It reminds me a little bit of what I've heard described about the tech used to mine bitcoins.
Yeah, yeah, those guys are using Arcotech, but they don't have the resources of Goldman Sachs is the issue.
If it's questionable whether or not it's legal, then just eliminate the practice altogether in that way.
Then you eliminate like innovation and risk, right? Like that's the big problem. The politics of this, and like for some reason this episode is coming down to politics a lot, but you don't want to discourage innovation. So you want to have it there. You just need an SEC that can handle it properly.
But you want to level the playing field. You don't want to create an unfair advantage.
Well, does finance
advantage.
Want to level the playing field? Or does finance want to force competition? So a lot of finance guys will be like, well, they should just do better. And a lot more people are like, well, there's no way to compete because you stack the odds against me. And that's the Michael Lewis's book's question.
Yeah.
Another place to look for information on this is Planet Money. It's an NPR WNYC-based podcast that, you know, they do like 20 minutes a week or something, and they do a pretty good job of laying out how all this stuff started. I'll find the link and I'll give it to you and you can put it on the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. I think one way or the other, the market will self-correct based on the popular, basically the popular stance on this. However this works out, it'll self-correct.
The only problem there is that it may self-correct only after certain people have gotten rich at the expense of others.
No, there's nothing you can do about that.
Well,
the horse is already out.
Regulators, if the horse is out of the barn, but regulators can definitely, if they figure out what the issues were before, they can fine those companies the way that they went down on AIG after the financial crash.
Right, right.
You just don't want a situation where people think that, as much as you want innovation to happen, you don't want a place where people think that they can be above the system and get away with things, or else you'll have more abuses, more corruption, and we will end up with another crash, another recession.
Right, right, right. We don't want that. Okay, well, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that we're going to talk about this week is, of course, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt by Michael Lewis, which is the subject of the last story we just talked about. Michael Lewis is the best-selling author of Boomerang, The Big Short, The Blind Side, Moneyball, and many others. And is there anything in addition to what we just talked about over the last story about that you want to add about this book? Have you read this book?
I have. It's a pretty, I mean, I kind of grabbed it the minute it came out. It's a good book. It's smart. It's clever. And what he does is he doesn't just kind of like report on it as if he's some sort of like New York Times or NPR reporter. He creates a story around it. Mm-hmm. He creates a story around it that allows us that allows him to explain to us what's going on. In his story, it takes about 3 months for his protagonist to figure out what's going on. And it does, I mean, it's a dramatization, and that kind of gets in the way, perhaps, from some people's perspective, of getting to the thick of things, to the thick of it, to the heart of it all. But at the same time, I think it's necessary in order to have a good narrative that truly explains what's going on. So it's a good story because it's not just some sort of like reporter book. Here's the data. It's not Freakonomics. It's literally like a good narrative. It's got a good tale to tell, and it's worth reading or listening to on Audible.
And it can be yours. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that audiobook. It's narrated by Dylan Baker, who's the same guy who narrated the Steve Jobs biography and who's a well-known character actor. He's one of those guys where you'd know his face if you saw him. I'm going to put this on my short list of Audible buys when I get my credits next as well. It sounds fascinating. You don't have to get that book. Audible has over 100,000 plus titles to choose from. And even if you don't like the service, you can cancel and still keep the book for free. So again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. That helps us on the show. That book can be yours. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, did the U.S. create a Twitter to destabilize Cuba? Take a listen to this and come on back.
Chan chan, en el mar servía una arena, como sacudí el jibe, a chan chan le daba pena. De Alto Cedro voy para Marcané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarí.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas. The Associated Press reported last week that in July 2010, U.S. government officials working for the U.S. Agency for International Development executed a plan to launch a messaging network that could reach hundreds of thousands of Cubans. The plan was to develop a bare-bones Cuban Twitter using cell phone text messaging to evade Cuba's strict control of information and its stranglehold restrictions over the internet. In a play on the name Twitter, it was called Zunzunio, which is slang for a Cuban hummingbird's tweet. At its peak, the project drew in more than 40,000 Cubans to share news and exchange opinions. But its subscribers were never aware that it was created by the U.S. government or that American contractors were gathering their private data in the hope that it might be used for political purposes. The AP article that investigates this is fascinating because they go into how they had operatives planned who would populate this Zunzunio with innocuous tweets, and that the idea was that they would eventually ramp up their innocuous tweets into tweets that would the idea would be to foment sort of foment a revolution in Cuba amongst the youth, like get the youth hooked on using Zunzunio. And then eventually sort of change the message from within.
I mean, it's really interesting, especially because U.S. telephone companies just got the ability to hop in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I am not at all surprised. I think that it's kind of funny that they tried this and it didn't work. It's partly because it wasn't the organic movement that Twitter is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Twitter is still available over text messaging. The idea of creating something new over text messaging is kind of strange. I don't know. It's we like to see the internet being open, not used for the purposes of disrupting governments, whatever. Cuba's current government is not one that I would want to live under, but let's just remember that it was the product of a revolution that everybody and their mother supported. Now, again, is majority always the right way to go? Probably not in many cases, especially in the case of Cuba, where they have cars from the 1950s and they're currently like slowly opening up things because they know they can't sustain their shit. But this is the level of U.S. intervention that is definitely not the kind of thing that we need in an age where our own allies are wondering for spying on us or soaking dissent. It would have been better if we just had thrown in Twitter and been like, we want to get people on Twitter in Cuba via the text messages. It's a little embarrassing, especially because it didn't work.
Right, right.
It's the internet's version of the Bay of Pigs, right? So
they closed up shop in 2012.
Right. Right.
But I think it's
40,000 users is like, I don't know how many people live in Cuba, maybe 2 million. But it's like,
ugh. 40,000 users is a good start. Sure.
No, that's true. Not many people there, in 2010, yeah, yeah. A lot of people may not have had cell phones. It's a poor country. But
11 million citizens in Cuba.
11 million! Okay, that makes the 40,000 number sound even worse. But, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I used to be like, this is one of those things where I imagine the CIA was involved.
Yeah.
And once again, the CAA is not good at things. the President Clinton was not calling the CIA about the bombs in Kosovo. Like, ever since then, the CIA was the first guy to say, Russia's not going to invade Crimea. No way. Like, the CIA sucks.
Yeah.
So I know I'm going to get flagged for that shit. But, the bottom line is, if this was the product of the CAA, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they were trying to create essentially like a Cuban Spring in the same vein.
A Latin Spring.
Yeah, yeah. Latin Spring.
Just wait it out. I mean, the Castros aren't going to live
yeah,
forever.
Yeah, that's exactly.
We all know
right.
that as you're a Latin person, I'm a Latin person. I'm just telling you that Latin people like money. they like capitalism. You wait it out. there's going to be enough to go around. Those guys cannot keep this kind of communist totalitarian regime in stock forever. I know there are a lot of Americans who want to get their hands on Cuban real estate, Cuban whatever, but I guarantee you, without us sullying or like putting egg on our face by not getting it right with these weird covert measures.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible to let the tech just handle it.
If there's one thing the U.S. has a long track record of, it's failure to destabilize Cuba.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you got to know when you're beaten, and the Castros have beat us, so we just have to wait till they either die or give up.
Yeah.
We're not going to beat them at their own game.
Okay, so moving on here. Microsoft is going Hollywood with a cast including comedians Sarah Silverman and Seth Green, aspiring World Cup players and eerily human robots. All are involved in shows that Microsoft's new Xbox television studio plans to roll out globally starting in June. Microsoft hired CBS Corp former CBS honcho Nancy Tellem 19 months ago to build a TV powerhouse from the ground up. And the studio now has 6 series lined up, including...
Is Heroes one of them?
No.
I didn't think so.
But you know what's interesting?
Thank God that Heroes is not one of them. If I had to see the Zachary Quinto guy on stage,
you know Heroes is coming back. You know that, right? Heroes is coming back.
Who's bringing it back? NBC?
It's
Universal?
NBC Universal again, bringing Heroes back. It's going to be helmed by the same creator who helmed it before. All I can say about that is as long as it's...
But the couple broke up. The whole Milo Ventimiglia and Hayden Panettiere, they broke up. It's over.
As long as it's comparable to the first season and not at all like the second or later seasons.
Second, third, or fourth season.
Oh, good God,
It'll be okay. Yeah, the first season was reasonable. Kind of like Lost. First season was great. Everything else sucked the dick.
Oh, don't even.
Should I?
Don't even get me started on don't even.
It did come out.
We're
going
to come to blows,
Lost.
My friend.
Yeah, it did come out alongside Lost, and it was pretty clear a couple seasons in that it was not as powerful as that show.
Yeah.
And I think I remember Jay Leno using Heroes as an example of like how NBC has awful television shows. The show that everybody wanted to work. I mean, Alphas, Heroes. It sounds to me like we just need a good X-Men TV show.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like. Because all these shows are basically that. These people are mutants and they can do cool shit.
Well, until Marvel Studios gets the rights back to the X-Men.
From Fox.
I don't think that's going to happen.
It's not in the cards, but maybe Fox can pull it off. I don't know. Bottom line is Microsoft is trying to pull the Netflix, trying to pull the Amazon, trying to bring this content in. And kudos to them. You know, the Xbox is their growth piece.
Yeah.
The Xbox is the piece that talks to multiple generations. It's in the living room. And even if the people aren't getting it through the Xbox, they're getting it through some Microsoft-enabled online service that Microsoft allows us to log into or whatever.
That's fine
too. But you know, the more content, the better. And you know, CBS is considered the champagne network because it has some of the greatest shows. Grabbing the head of that in order to pull together content, another kudos.
See, that's really the takeaway from this article is that Microsoft recognizes that with the Xbox particularly as a that they're coming sort of to the end of they've reached saturation point with the Xbox as a game system. They recognize its ability and popularity of use as a set-top box, and now they're following the footsteps of Amazon, Netflix, etc. And they've recognized that the wave of the future, if they really want to stay relevant, they create their own content specifically for the platform. It's really an interesting way to go because it.
That's the way Apple's in it too.
Right, but
making content exclusive to the platform.
It totally disrupts the old guard of. Content being created by these major network properties.
Does it though? Because I feel like when the Xbox came out, one of the reasons why they called it the Xbox back in 2001 was because they wanted it to serve all these purposes: gaming, watching a movie, doing whatever. The Xbox original did not pull that all off properly. The Xbox 360 made a gamble on HD DVD that really didn't work well.
Yeah.
The 360 is a chance to do it, and you know, like, as much as the PS4 has a lot going for it, the 360 started off telling users that they're trying to work with cable companies like Comcast and Time Warner to get their device to be the set-top box for those other devices. Now, that business development did not pan out the way they wanted it to at Microsoft. You cannot simply have an Xbox One as your cable box. But that was the plan in the beginning. So they're focused on this. They believe that their position in the marketplace, their superior interface, because everything's superior to the cable interfaces, is one that consumers want and that can revitalize growth in a world of cord cutting for these Comcast, Time Warner, Optimum type companies. So we'll see how it goes. But I mean, I think it's important to everyone that content be distributed across multiple types of networks, multiple ways of knowing, because it's only better for the consumer. Now, Game of Thrones is on Netflix, but it's available on Amazon right now. House of Cards. This is a word that confuses me. House of Cards is available on Netflix, but it's also available on Amazon right now, the first season. So these things trickle into one another, and then they're all new ways of knowing. So you don't necessarily have to have, unless you want everything when it immediately comes out, you don't have to have every box to pull it off. So that's another interesting thing about mm-hmm. this.
Yeah, I think, basically the trend is that everyone is creating their own content these days.
Yeah, more content, the better.
Yep.
Just make it better than Silicon Valley's pilot, that's all. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Buffy's pilot sucked too. And it's possibly the greatest show that was ever on TV. So,
speaking of HBO, with more than 1 million downloads in half a day, the premiere of Game of Thrones' fourth season has set a new piracy record. People from all over the world grabbed a copy at its height. Over 300,000 BitTorrent users were sharing the episode simultaneously.
That's crazy. 300,000?
Yeah. 300,000 simultaneous.
That must have downloaded at like 5 megabits a second for people in developed countries.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty amazing. And we've already heard HBO's CEO stance on piracy of Game of Thrones. He basically said that it doesn't really affect their bottom line. The show is so popular, it's going to be popular anyway. He doesn't mind if people, although he doesn't condone.
That doesn't change the law, though.
Yeah, no, right.
That sharing
right.
an episode of Game of Thrones puts you at risk for a $30,000 fine for the sharing. And if you're a user, keep that in mind. I know there's a statute of limitations for 3 years after it's happened. So mm-hmm. you could get, quote-unquote, caught up to 3 years after it's happened. Now, I've never heard of anything having 300,000 seeds. It very well could be that Time Warner, the parent company of Game of Thrones, sees this news and says, okay, we need to think about a crackdown. So just beware, guys. Should you get a letter from your cable company saying your IP was associated with the downloading of this shit, you know, settle. Settle, settle, settle. Do not try to take that shit to court.
Even HBO's own HBO Go service crashed.
Did not work that day. Yeah. A lot of people were unable to see it. I have HBO and HBO Go. I went to take a look at it, and frankly, I mean, HBO, first of all, Sunday was a banner night for television.
Yeah,
Sunday,
yeah.
What was it, April 8th, April 7th, or April 7th of 2014?
Sundays are usually great nights for television, but this was last one was
particularly,
yeah,
it was – it had the first episode of everything from Nurse Jackie to mm-hmm. three separate shows on HBO. The Silicon Valley show we've spoken about, Veep, the third season, which is a in the loop, in the thick of it kind of political TV comedy show, very popular, as well as Game of Thrones. And across TV, there were at least four others. So the internet was screwed on Sunday night, and HBO Go servers were definitely screwing something. If they were using Amazon, they must have spun up 150% what they normally have spun up. So it's incredible that technology works the way it works, but I can totally see why it would have crashed that night. Sorry to anybody who had to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Big night, big show. I loved it, by the way. I saw the premiere episode. I'm guessing you have too.
I have.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I used to just wait until the season was over and then I would binge watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
Especially because, like, you know, getting home on a Sunday from the mountains was always an issue, that kind of thing, because we go up and we ski or whatever. This time around, we were home. Mm-hmm. We did manage to watch it, and it wasn't half bad. I think it was pretty good. I think for me, the only thing about Game of Thrones that I'd like to see more of is I need more dragon.
It's coming. You know, I mean, it's coming. You know it's coming better than I do.
I've read all the books. Yeah. I need more dragon.
All right. Well, there's not going to be any more dragon than there are in the books, so you tell me.
I'm saying, like, I just feel like there's not as much dragon in this show as, and maybe that's because the dragons are beautiful on this TV show.
Yeah.
Like, they make them all pterodactyl looking with the whole front paws or part of the wings instead of like some lizard with back wings.
I think they're getting better too. Like this season's dragon cameos look better than the first dragon.
Oh, wait, time is moving it all forward. There's no doubt. And the dragons are getting bigger. Viseron is my favorite, and he's doing pretty well. But I just feel like I need a bit more dragon, because dragons run this shit of the Song of Ice and Fire universe.
Yeah, yeah.
So I also want that George R. R. Martin to finish the damn books.
Yes. Well, Yes.
You mentioned some news about that he's already briefed the general outline to
Benioff and Weiss.
Benioff.
Yeah, the two co-creators of the series, Benioff and Weiss, George R. R. Martin had a sit down with them, and basically outlined the entire rest of the saga to them in sort of brief notes, brief
high
bullet
level
points of where he's going with the show in the event
that something should happen.
That
to
something
him
should happen.
It's all finished.
Yes,
because the man is
wood.
Old. He's not finishing the books, and I don't know what to do. I'm sitting there looking at my file. I read them twice. That's like 20,000 pages reading those things twice, and I need more.
He's not in the best. He's not the most fit person in the world either.
And he's not young, and he's just walking between cottage and cottage in New Mexico, writing down a page a day. And I'm not gonna lie, it hurts.
Yeah, there have been some preview chapters on the internet.
Oh yeah, I don't believe. I can't do that. I gotta read it all at once. I got to read it fast. For those who haven't read the books, right now the TV show has mirrored the available books, which is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But books, from what I can tell, from what's out there, books five and six or four and five, some of the books are the same time period, segmented characters. So only certain characters are in one book, certain characters in another. So the show's at a place where it's beginning to have to deal with that. Luckily, the guy who wrote them is right there on the set and everything. But if you're a geek and you've read this stuff, which is just golden stuff. I mean, his work is rivaling Tolkien, if it hasn't eclipsed Tolkien yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just great. And the show is good, and HBO Go is a fantastic service. I think we all can't wait until HBO Go just is a standalone service, but it won't happen if Comcast is, you know, buys Time Warner, which owns HBO. They were in talks today with they began their hearings in Congress. They're trying to get it pushed through. We'll see what happens.
This is the day, by the way, that they were also rated the worst customer service company in America.
Right. So April 9th, 2014, Comcast is in Congress saying, hey, man, we need to make it better by buying this other company and becoming the biggest company in the world on this shit. And meanwhile, they rated the worst. Planet Money had a great episode on All Things Considered today, basically talking about they interviewed a person in Britain, and they said, so tell us about the internet company options you have.
and the woman listed off the person they were talking to listed off like 7 or 8 different internet companies. She can go to her local department store and buy a bedspread and get internet service from them, high speed. because in that country, that's how they do it. In the UK, you have multiple options. But in the US, basically Comcast and the other guys have said the only way you're going to get fast internet is if you have a monopoly until all this 4G stuff can help you out. But that's all not viable right now. So in the US, we're really stuck, and it's a big, big problem. Special interests are going to run that problem for a long time.
Yeah, well, I don't see that that's going to change anytime soon with lobbies, basically, you know.
Yeah, these special – I mean, I feel like I feel like we need a Fight Club style, you know, messing it all up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then that would ruin my internet connection. I won't be able to see Game of Thrones, so don't ever do that.
All right, moving on here. Micro, an unusually sleek 3D printer, hit $1 million in funding on Kickstarter just a day after it started raising funds. And is about to hit the $2 million mark as we speak. The project hits the sweet spot for anyone interested in 3D printing, as it might be the first commercially viable $300 3D printer the world has ever seen. It's notably light, weighing just 2.2 pounds. The success of Micro and other projects such as Robo3D seems to indicate that the market for such devices will only truly take off once their price drops to between $300 and $400, which just happens to be the price of a video game console. These current Kickstarter projects are steps towards the movement when one 3D printer...
And the price of an iPad.
Yes. Yes. I mean, the price that you would expect to pay for
a high-end personal bit of electronics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, one thing that to mention, and not that I want to cut off your sure, read sure. of your read of this this work but on Board Genius Report, but one of the big things about Micro is that you're going to hit $1 million in a day if you have a good device that has a $300 price tag. A lot of Kickstarters are $25, $100, but the $300 price tag on what is really one of the hottest technologies around is going to show that people are all about it. So this is the first truly consumer 3D printer, and it's intuitive to use, and it's easy to own. And these guys are going to, if this thing takes off, they're going to make a fortune on like the plastics alone, you know?
The Kuitinen. Upshot of Tero Kuitinen's article here is that 2014 or 2015 could be the breakthrough year for 3D printing industry. Once they get the devices get down to the price point where people expect to pay for personal electronics, and I think that's exciting. I think, unfortunately, though, the unfortunate thing about this is that at that price point, what you get, the bang for your buck, what you get for your price is still, you know, prohibitively small. Like this Micro 3D printer is really too small to do anything really useful out of
you can make toys.
Tiny toys. You can make McDonald's toys. Happy Meal toys.
Yeah, you can make simple toys. But I think what it does is it serves the purpose of creative people who want to create a proof of concept.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
A scalable proof of concept. Because your plans, your designs on the computer are scalable. You'll be able to take them and move them to a bigger 3D printer. But to make that first proof of concept prototype, or if you're going to make a more complex device and you need to make multiple pieces that then come together to create a movable type of device, Micro still works pretty well. And that's the big thing here. Many people with 3D printers are building out custom bits of hardware for larger devices. Or if you're a person who's got something in their home that needs that fixing or you need to replace a part of something and it can be made out of this resilient plastic situation, you can build it out of a Micro. So I think there are applications for this.
I just – I'm looking at it and I was like, what can you – because if you look at the article, they show you an example – or if you go to the Kickstarter, maybe that's what it is, and they show you sort of what you can do with it.
They got a ring. They got an awful rabbit that's terrible. Why would they make a rabbit? Ugh, disgusting.
And those tiny little vases, those kind of useless little vases. Like they're
decorative. I mean, you could make a wide range of dollhouse furniture with this micro 3D. That's about it.
You should write that down. That's really funny. I think you can make parts for more important things. Yeah.
And I like your idea about, you know, being a low cost way to make sort of proof of concept, a scalable proof of concept. But I mean, the idea of bringing the price point down to between $300 and $400 is to make it, to democratize it, to make it so that anyone can buy this. But your typical gadget consumer isn't going to spend $300 and $400 so they could make a prototype that needs to be scaled up. They're going to buy it so they can...
I think it enables, democratizes manufacturing, right?
Yeah.
So, like, yeah. I, there are a lot of people out there who are geeks who can't afford $2,100 for a 3D printer. And they're like, if I get one of these, I can at least test it out. At the very least, those early adopters are going to spend money. I think if it were $400, $500, it were bigger... Yes, yeah. It'd be totally worth it. And it would probably have more impact. But this is bringing a lot of buzz to the space. And it's
Absolutely.
It's allowing a lot more people to get involved. And I think there's a possibility that you can make pretty serious components for larger devices in it. This could be the new, I think 3D printing is the new Lego, right, of our time. When we were kids, Lego's a lot like coding. You only have so many pieces, but you can make anything you want. 3D printing, I think, has to be the same. The big trick is when the design of the products you're making in your printer still requires a pretty profound knowledge of a kind of CAD type design
sure.
program in order to pull it off. When they can make it so that I can take a stylus to a tablet, or I can put on a VR set of goggles and kind of stretch a bit of goo or silly putty into some sort of shape and have the 3D printer make that, that's when it's really going to become big, because you won't need that level. I mean, how many people could use Logo today, right? Like, you need somebody who is powerful at making these sorts of devices, these sorts of, like, the software, powerful at manipulating the software in order to make these devices. So that's always going to be hard, but hey, man.
I think this is a good evolutionary first step. But really, I mean, I think
what the original iPod.
Yeah. What you want is something at the same price point, but exponentially larger. And
well,
the other
actually maybe twice as large. You don't need it to be like six times.
I want it to be two or three times as big, so I can make some really big stuff. And the other barrier to entry,
you need an iTunes store is what you need. You need something where you can download a spec to make something. Where there's like an app store.
Yeah. That's coming too. There's plenty. Shapeways.
What?
Have you ever been to Shapeways?
I haven't been to Shapeways, but that's really what needs to happen. You need to have that on a big, big, big level. You need somebody to be able to say, I'm going to, I'm a company, I'm the little app store or whatever, and I've made six or seven different types of things that work with this. These guys have to have software that's more robust than what I've seen on their video. They've got to do what Pebble did, essentially. They've got to do what Pebble did, have their app be its own app store, and you can buy shapey shit out of that. That's what they have to do. That's their power.
That's essentially Shapeways. Shapeways is kind of like an Etsy for 3D printing.
Good. It just has to be linked to a piece of hardware that is standardized. Yeah. You can't, you know, like, it's not going to work for everything. It needs to really be tied to like one piece of hardware, one platform, and it has to be integrated. You just can't have your hardware without your software these days.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like the other barrier to entry for 3D printing, and something that no one really talks about, is the material itself.
The spool. So they got a plan for the spools on the website. You know, you can buy the spools with the 3D printer or whatever.
Sure, but it's still expensive. The material is still expensive. Like, when they can get, I mean, it's all, and I think there seems to be a price-fixing lock on it. Because it's all recycled material as it is. If we can get that down to where, you know, you can, the spools are relatively cheap, a lot cheaper than they are currently, or where you can make your own spools out of your own recycled plastic. I think then,
I mean, that'd be hard. It has to be really consistent in order for it to work. I'm just happy that it works as a like everyone can use some of the same shit. Like you don't have to buy branded shit for every printer. Like that's where I'm most happy right now. But yeah, there's three elements here. The device, the spool, and the software. Like you go to the iPod example again. Yeah. All you need is the iPod and internet connection. You need the device. You need the internet connection. You need the spool. And you need the software. And then you need the know-how. So there are a lot of barriers to entry. This is the hockey of tech in terms of having to have all the pieces together as opposed to like the soccer or basketball of tech where you just need the one thing to get it going. There's a lot of challenges here.
Yeah.
But the fact is, I think it's pretty clear that somewhere between virtual reality and 3D printing, the next big jump after the touchscreen capacitive multi-touch telephone device is one of these two things, 3D printing or VR.
Yeah, we are, you know, we're living in the future and we are on the cusp of it.
No, I was born too early. Like, I need more.
It's coming. It's coming. Okay, and the last story of the evening, Uber, which has quickly become one of the easiest alternatives to get from one place to another, want to help get things to you. They recently announced Uber Rush, an experimental bicycle delivery service, launching first with limited availability in Manhattan. Deliveries will start at a flat fee of $15 with additional charges based on zoning. Thankfully, they don't have surge pricing yet. And in addition to bikes, couriers will also use Subway to get around. I think this is interesting development because, you know, Uber has sort of disrupted the paid transportation service, such as, you know, public transportation and taxis. And brought transportation to the sort of the grassroots, you know, in this, they've done for transportation what Airbnb has done for lodging. And I think that's interesting that they're breaking into deliveries in the same.
Someone has to do it. Deliveries in metropolitan areas. It is a low-hanging fruit if you have the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those things. I mean, TaskRabbit tried this. Even in the town of Amherst, where I went to school with Tosin and Devingra and Chris Bernor, we had a service called Delivery Express, which did this because it could handle that area. Uber's got the infrastructure, the technology, their back end could easily supply a user with connections to their bicycle-laden transporter, whatever. So they've got that. They just really need to find the labor that needs to be cheap, and they need to get this to get the products, the right set of products out there. I think this is a big deal, and I think it's putting Uber in a position where companies that are fulfillment based, like Amazon, are really going to begin to look at them to see what they could pull off for them, either in partnership or through acquisition.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this was one of those ideas that just when I saw it, I'm like, I smacked myself on the head. And this is so obvious. And I'm glad that Uber jumped on this. But
yeah, Lyft will jump on it. All the other ones will jump on it too. And, you know, this will become regular. Like getting around a city on a bicycle is not a hard thing. It's the coordination between the user and the service that needs to be provided, whether it's pick me up food from this place that doesn't deliver or bring me something from Radio Shack because I need to plug it into, you know, my system or whatever. You know what I mean? Like it's all important stuff. It could have all happened before, but it just needed this handheld, fast network, big infrastructure situation in order to really pull it off.
Okay, so that's it for our show, with the exception of mentioning that the drill down video of the week that we're going to have in our show notes is going to be the pilot episode of Silicon Valley, which we discussed at the top of the show. HBO has made that available on YouTube, so we're making it available to you so you can check it out. And then to ask you, Dwayne, where can we find your work on the internet outside of the drill down?
Find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. And also find me on Instagram, but you'll see a lot of cat pictures. Same handle. And you can always find me on Gmail, I mean, Google Plus, skplus.to/DwayneD. And as always, you know, I'm here on the drill down week after week.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, and if you do a Google search for Mr. Baby Man, you'll find all my social media links and other work on the internet there. You can because basically that's my social media handle, and all my stuff is there. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish here on The Drill Down. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful and loyal audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.